Day 410, Wednesday, May 15th, Ecclesiastes 9 part 2 of 2. This next verse, Ecclesiastes 9:9, presents a lifetime with one's wife in a very positive light, which helps to put Solomon's earlier statement about not finding a good woman in Ecclesiastes 7-2728 into fuller context. Failing to find a good woman had been his personal experience with his vast harem, but he still counseled that joy in marriage was attainable, one of God's great blessings during this life. As he also wrote in Proverbs 18:22, "He who finds a wife finds a good thing, and obtains favor from the Lord." And further positive affirmation and celebration of marital love is found in the Song of Solomon. It should be pointed out that some wrongly contend that Ecclesiastes 9:9 is not referring to marriage. The Tyndale commentary explains, because the term for wife here is simply woman, that is, the Hebrew can be translated either way, and because the HEB RU lacks the article and could mean a woman, it is thought by some that the preacher is urging sensuality without marriage. This neglects the background of Ecclesiastes in Genesis 1-11. Also, the style of HEB RU in Ecclesiastes tends to omit the article where other writers would have it, and wife whom you love could be understood as definite without the article. It is, therefore, precarious to base too much upon its absence. The companionship envisaged is lifelong, not a casual liaison. Footnote on Ecclesiastes 9:9. The wording may not seem quite so positive though, as the Preaching the Word commentary points out, telling husbands to enjoy their wives all the days of your vain life that he has given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life, Ecclesiastes 9:9. This is hardly the kind of statement that a woman is hoping to find written on her anniversary card. The preacher is no more sentimental about marriage than he is about anything else in life. But this does not make him a cynic. On the contrary, he is giving a serious view of life that makes room for joy but also faces up to the sober realities of life in a fallen world and the inevitable reality of death. P. 215. Some see the vanity or frustration, the breath or vapor, in this verse as referring to life being fleeting or short, yet it still seems likely to refer to the entire panoply of frustration this world presents that leads to the sudden finality of death, as in verse 3, with the directive to live joyfully with one's spouse as a way to experience lifelong blessing in the midst of life's troubles. Consider the seeming oxymoron of live joyfully, all the days of your vain life. Yet it makes sense if we recognize that every day, despite the day's problems, we can still experience joys that marriage provides, and more so over the years, as long as we have life. And in fact, as should be encouraging to those who are not married, we can experience joys from many other God-given gifts each day and throughout life, as Solomon has just mentioned and as he will later reaffirm despite life's vanity, see Ecclesiastes 11:8. Interestingly, several commentaries point out that the directives to joyfully eat, drink, wear festive clothes, put on perfume oils and love one's wife were found in other ancient sources, which makes sense when we consider that Solomon had an international empire and was a collector of wisdom. The NIV Cultural Background Study Bible notes on Ecclesiastes 9:7-9. These verses include some of the most remarkable parallels between a scriptural text and other ancient Near Eastern texts found anywhere in the Bible. The song from the tomb of King Intef, from the Egyptian harper's songs, confronts human mortality and offers the following advice: put myrrh on your head, dress in fine linen, anoint yourself with oils fit for a god. Another of the harper's songs, Neferhotep I, has similar advice. Take fine perfumes pleasing to your nostrils, with garlands, lotuses, and berries at your breast, with your sister, who is in your heart, happy at your side. Sister here refers to one's wife. Another strikingly similar text is in the old Babylonian Gilgamesh epic, where the hero laments over mortality to an alewife, and she gives him this advice: when the gods created mankind, for mankind they established death, life they kept for themselves. / you, Gilgamesh, let your belly be full. Keep enjoying yourself, day and night. / every day make merry, dance and play day and night. / let your clothes be clean. / let your head be washed, may you be bathed in water. / gaze on the little one who holds your hand. / let a wife enjoy your repeated embrace. Our three different sources, Babylonian, Egyptian and Israelite, have essentially the same message: in light of the brevity of life, enjoy yourself. This, of itself, may not be too remarkable, but the specific nature and sequence of the advice, feasting, wearing clean clothes, anointing with oils and perfumes, and enjoying one's wife, suggests a common wisdom tradition. Solomon made good use in Ecclesiastes of this proverbial encouragement, but in a different way from these other sources. As the Preaching the Word commentary notes, all of the passages where he gives this call to enjoyment have God at their center. This immediately distinguishes Ecclesiastes from ancient writings like the Epic of Gilgamesh. Why should we enjoy eating and drinking and working, the last item mentioned next? In chapter 2, it is because these activities are God's gift to man, v. 13. The same is true in chapter 5, which also says that God keeps us occupied with joy in our hearts, v. 20. The preacher may be frustrated with life in this fallen world, but he still acknowledges the gifts that come from the hand of God. We see this perhaps most clearly in Ecclesiastes 9, where the preacher tells us to enjoy bread and wine because God has already approved what you do, v. 7, in terms of desiring that we enjoy life, as we've seen, p. 213. Moreover, the next line of the Gilgamesh poem after listing the things in life to enjoy says, "These things alone are the concern of men." Solomon, on the other hand, presents a much bigger picture as the concern of men, God having put eternity in their hearts, Ecclesiastes 3:11, and concludes his treatise by stating that man's responsibility is to fear God and keep his commandments, Ecclesiastes 12:13. We must enjoy God's gifts in that context. Deuteronomy 12:14 and 16 instructed the Israelites to set aside a tenth of their income so the whole family could rejoice before him at his annual festivals, enjoying grain, wine, oil and meat, with a major part of the reason being that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always, Ecclesiastes 14:23. In what we've gone over of the refrain in Ecclesiastes 9 so far, verses 7 to 9, we've seen the following enjoyment recommended: feasting, with both contentment and comfort, and marital relations and companionship, PTW, P. 213, NAC, note on verses 7 to 10. Then at the end of verse 9 and in verse 10 we are given another area of life from which to derive joy, work or occupation. Verse 9, again, says to live joyfully with one's wife, for that is your portion in life, and in the labor which you perform under the sun. This might seem to read that living joyfully with one's wife is the portion in one's life and the portion in one's labor. But that does not make the best sense here. Of course, enjoying one's marriage is indeed a product of working to make a good marriage, but labor has been used more generally throughout the book, as we'll recount in a moment, and the same appears true here. The verse can be more clearly read to say live joyfully with one's wife for that is your portion in life, and also live joyfully in the labor which you perform under the sun, which is also one's portion. This transitions into verse 10 regarding working with all of our might. As noted earlier, Dr. Kaiser's outline has verse 10 beginning a new subsection of the last part of the book, And certainly the next subsection does build on the idea of working with all one's strength, along with wisdom. Yet the labor at the end of verse 9, with exhortation concerning it continuing into verse 10, was clearly presented in earlier occurrences of the refrain. As noted in previous comments, Solomon stated in Ecclesiastes 2:24 that it's not inherent within man that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also, I saw, was from the hand of God. In Ecclesiastes 3:13 he said that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. In Ecclesiastes 3:22 he said that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. In Ecclesiastes 5:18-19 he said, it is good and fitting for one to eat and drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun, for it is his heritage. To receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. And where Solomon commended physical enjoyment in 8:15, he said, for this will remain with him in his labor all the days of his life. So it stands to reason that labor or work in general is again part of the refrain in chapter 9. In verse 9 to enjoy and in verse 10 is something desirable to participate in before one can anymore when taken in death. Furthermore, verse 10 reiterates the point of verses 4 to 6, that life is better than death as the dead know nothing, with feelings and opportunities coming to an end. These verses seem to mark an inclusio, the literary device wherein specific words or themes are used as verbal brackets or bookends at the beginning and end of a passage to set it off, which is more reason to see verse 10 as going with the preceding verses and thus marking the end of the subsection here. The refrain in verses 7 to 10 would then be the latter half of the inclusio of verses 4 to 10. The inclusio itself being the latter half of the subsection from 8:16-9:10. Additionally, the wording of verse 11, I returned and saw, seems to be the start of new material, though building on what's just been mentioned. Concerning the enjoyment of good in man's work, some see this as merely enjoying the fruit of one's labor, the end product of the work or what the work earns and is able to buy. And of course there is great value in work in that regard. But there is also enjoyment to be found in work itself, despite the curse of hardship and toil that Adam brought on himself and his descendants through sin, see Genesis 3:17-19. It feels good to be productive, and that's in whatever your hand finds to do, not just your career. A feeling of achievement and satisfaction comes from a job well done. And even while the job is being done, provided we are not being oppressed or overwhelmed in it. If simply doing nothing is so great, then why is the fact that in the grave there is no work or device, no inventive way of going about things, or knowledge or wisdom, thus no expertise or skill to apply, a negative? Clearly it is better to be active in doing things, whatever it is we can do, as best we can, for as long as we can. Recall that laziness or idleness was decried in Ecclesiastes 4:5, as it will be again in Ecclesiastes 10:18. But also bear in mind that being a workaholic for the big payoff or reward was decried as well, Ecclesiastes 4:6-8. We should strive to do well in whatever work we engage in, yet still allow time to enjoy other things and other people, along with downtime to rest and rejuvenate, as we have the freedom to do so. God himself set the example of rest and gave the Sabbath for this purpose. Recall from our introduction a thematic relation between the observance of the Sabbath and the refrains and conclusions of Ecclesiastes. Moreover, whatever work we are engaged in, we should consider that we are working for God as the one we should be seeking to please. Colossians 3:23 echoes the first part of Ecclesiastes 9:10 in saying, and whatever you do, do it heartily, as to the Lord and not to men. The word heartily here is from the Greek exousios, meaning from out of one's soul, or being, meaning that we give it our all, including all our might. That fits with considering what we do as service to God, as we are to love and obey God with all our heart, soul, or being, mind and strength or might, Deuteronomy 6:5, Mark 12:30. Consider also that the New Testament encourages us to exhibit virtue, 2 Peter 1:5, or, as the Greek word eretia entails, excellence, the highest quality state that can be reached. God is a God of excellence, verse 3, and he wants us to strive for that too. We are not to be lackadaisical and half-hearted. Romans 12:11 tells us that we should be not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. We should be committed to and passionate about what we put our hand to, and, again, do our best. With God at the center of the duty and enjoyment of our work and living in general, we will keep a right focus in what we do. Of course, not all of us have the same capacity when it comes to work. Thankfully, as noted in a popular Christian devotional, we serve a God who loves us more than our work. We must never forget this because there may come a time when our ability to do for God is torn from us by health or failure or unforeseen catastrophe. It is in those hours that God wants us to remember that he loves us not for what we do for him but because of who we are, his children. Randy Kilgore, Always Loved, Always Valued, Our Daily Bread, January 28, 2017, emphasis and original. This is quite true. Still, there is always something we can and must do, even if it is only to pray, and that should not be regarded in a belittled sense, as praying is one of the most important things we should be doing all the time. We don't need to worry about what we physically can't do. The important thing is to do what we can, and to do that with all our might. The warning about death at the end of verse 10 is to remind us that our time is ticking away. Verses 4 to 5 had presented the hope of the living as the awareness of coming death, the point being that in thinking about it there is an impetus to prepare for it, to do what we can. Well, your opportunity is now, Solomon says. You need to make the most of it. Carpe diem or seize the day, as we earlier saw. Paul later said in Ephesians 5:15 to 16 that we must be redeeming the time, because the days are evil, as they certainly are in this age, their distractions and problems often hindering us from progress we need to be making. See also Colossians 4:5. Let us be sure to make the most of the precious life we're given while we still have it, enjoying with grateful hearts the wonderful gifts God gives as we strive with all of our being to serve him in all we do. We saw in the opening of the first subsection of this last major section of the book that we can't really figure out all that God is working out with people in his great plan. There's a lot he hasn't let us in on, particularly when it comes to individual lives, including our own, C8:16-9-3. We see a little more of that here in this second subsection, Ecclesiastes 9:10-11-6. With things not always going as might be expected, a great deal of mystery yet remains. Outcomes in this age are uncertain. But that must not prevent us from following the directive we were given at the end of the previous subsection in Ecclesiastes 9:10, to strive to do whatever we do with all of our strength and ability. We must live boldly, yet with wisdom, including needed caution about the limitations of human ability and wisdom, and understanding of how to navigate this life. The current, second subsection is rather lengthy, yet is naturally further subdivided into three parts, as we are following in our readings, Ecclesiastes 9:10-10-3, Ecclesiastes 10:4-20, Ecclesiastes 11:1-6. As was mentioned before, Dr. Walter Kaiser's outline of the book places verse 10 at the beginning of the present subsection. However, the verse actually appears to end the previous subsection, and comments on verse 10 are found with those covering Ecclesiastes 8:16-9:10. Yet verse 10 can be regarded as transitional, Since the need to give it our all underlies much of the present subsection, this is why we are reading it again here. Still, it appears that the current subsection properly begins with verse 11, Solomon entering upon new material with the words, I returned and saw under the sun that. This return is following his investigation of the previous subsection to see the business that is done on earth, Ecclesiastes 8:16-17, where he realized that no one can really gain a handle on it all. He had further come to see that life is quite unpredictable, considering that the righteous and wicked often have the same experiences in life all the way to ultimately ending in death, Ecclesiastes 9:1-3. So he counseled that we need to be sure to enjoy life while we have it and make the most of it, doing what we can to prepare for the inevitable, verses 4-10. Yet in all this we need to keep in mind that much that happens remains beyond our control, and Solomon now goes on in verses 11-12 to show that this life is unpredictable every which way. The fastest person doesn't always win the race. He might trip and fall. He might get distracted. He might think he doesn't need to exert himself. He might not even show up. We've probably heard the fable of the tortoise and the hare, seeing that slow and steady wins the race. But of course that won't guarantee winning the race either. The swiftest typically do win. Just look at so many of the great Olympic champions who normally do win the gold medals. And the verse does not say otherwise. It means that the swiftest do not necessarily win. Likewise, the strongest don't always win the fight. Remember David and Goliath? And people who are wise and smart, even in matters of money, don't always end up prosperous. They may not even manage to eke out a living. Those who can best do the job are sometimes passed over. Someone else may have had a better in. Or the skillful person might have just had a bad day, failing in the instance he needed to prove himself. It just goes that way sometimes. The listed qualities in verse 11 are good to have, but things don't always fall out as expected. It just depends. Circumstances change things. Solomon remarks, as his words are often translated, but time and chance happen to them all. End of verse 11. More on this in a moment. And he goes on to say that man does not know his time, showing that people are like fish caught in a net or birds caught in a snare. So the sons of men are snared in an evil time, when it falls suddenly upon them. Verse 12. The reference here is to calamity, even death, but not necessarily death. It could be anything. Even if a person puts forth his or her best effort in work, strategy, knowledge and wisdom while there is life, as in verse 10, that will not guarantee success in these and shield against calamity. The discussion of time coming upon people in verses 11-12 recalls the earlier poem about the seasons of life in chapter 3, with there being a time for every purpose under heaven. Verse 1. The Hebrew word used in conjunction with time in Ecclesiastes 9:11, pega, translated chance, does not denote randomness but simply any event that might happen. The Expositor's Bible Commentary says that it contains less the idea of haphazard occurrence than an event that we meet, whether anticipated or unanticipated. Right, note on verses 11-12. A footnote here further explains that the word is used elsewhere only in 1 Kings 5:4, where it is qualified by evil, i.e., some adversity that has happened. The corresponding verb, yikre, rendered happen in Ecclesiastes 9:11, is used in the sense of meet, as in the Old English I chanced upon, for example, 1 Samuel 10-5. Furthermore, time and chance in Ecclesiastes 9:11 are not presented as two separate contingencies, but as a single factor. NIV Cultural Background Study Bible, note on verse 11. The reference is to meeting up with some happening at a particular time, that is, simply, circumstance. The Holman Old Testament Commentary, Moore, quotes the NIV Application Commentary, Ecclesiastes and Song of Songs, Ian Provan, In this regard, the NIV's chance, pega, is an unhappy choice of translation, since this word connotes an impersonal and random force, whereas Qohelet is clear throughout the book that human fate lies ultimately in God's hands, no matter how random and impersonal what befalls us may appear. The verbal form pg means to meet, encounter. A pega is simply something we encounter on the path of life, a circumstance or situation over which we have no control, p. 110. The event could possibly be random, but we must remember the context of verse 1, that whatever happens is in the hand of God. So with any random occurrence God is still sovereign, as it is always his decision whether to allow that occurrence to proceed or not. He can always intervene, and he does intervene for those who love and obey him, causing all things to work together for their ultimate good, Romans 8:28. Some, with a misconception about time and chance, imagine the righteous could die in an accident as the victim of random occurrence apart from God's purposes. So here would be God as the master potter in whose hands we are, Isaiah 64:8, as he molds and shapes us for what he is preparing us for in his kingdom. And then some random occurrence takes us out, with God saying, oops, lost that one. Really? Of course not. We need to realize that Ecclesiastes 9:11 does not even say there could be random occurrences. And even if it allows for that possibility, as it probably does, it is, again, always up to God whether to permit that happening. None of us are resigned to fate. Rather, we remain in the hands of our loving God. That being said, God will allow many things to befall us that we do not anticipate. And for those in the world at large, who are unrepentant, he may allow them to be swept away by calamities not specifically directed toward them, as we see in the example Jesus gave about the Tower of Siloam falling on people who were in the wrong place at the wrong time, Luke 13:4. He warned, unless you repent you will all likewise perish. This is not to say that the righteous could not have a tower fall on them, but it would only be with assurance that they remain in God's watchful care and are ready for the future he has prepared for them in his kingdom. Compare Isaiah 57 1-2, where the death of the righteous is within God's keeping and care. All of this shows that while we are to live with boldness, striving with our might, doing what we can in our endeavors, this must be tempered with wisdom in maintaining a healthy sense of uncertainty. Of course we should plan, but we need to know that our plans won't necessarily work out, so we need to be flexible. We should try to have contingency plans as prudent precaution. Still, we can't plan for every eventuality. We can't even imagine everything that might happen. We need to know that the best laid plans of mice and men often go awry. We need to recognize that whatever happens is ultimately up to God, and we don't know all that he will decide. One of Solomon's proverbs stated, "Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth," Proverbs 27:1. And the Apostle James expanded on this, telling us we must not boast in personal plans, which is vanity, but must keep in mind God's sovereignty over the future, James 4:13-16. Thus, it really comes down to this. Above all, we need to maintain a right relationship with God, so that we remain in his care when the unexpected hits us. This is the very counsel the conclusion of Ecclesiastes gives us. The proper mindset and approach here is a part of wisdom. Despite the limitations of wisdom we've seen, not being able to figure everything out, Ecclesiastes 8:16-17, not even always gaining needed food to eat, Ecclesiastes 9:11, and still meeting with this life's calamities and even death, verses 1-3, 10-12, wisdom is not useless. In fact, it's part of wisdom to understand this, that wisdom is helpful even though it can't solve everything, as Solomon next lays out in verses 13-18. Here he gives the case, whether actual or thought up, of a small city besieged by the forces of a great king but delivered by a poor wise man though he's forgotten, verses 13 to 16. The Tyndale Old Testament Commentaries volume on Ecclesiastes, Eaton, says that verse 15 might be translated to mean that a poor wise man's wisdom possibly could have saved the city but that no one thought of him, CGNT, Neb, and NASP footnote. However, as the Preaching the Word commentary footnotes, this translation requires an interpretive choice it describes as reading between the lines, and without more context it seems best to go with a common translation, that the poor man did deliver the city and was then forgotten, Ryken, p. 295. Here then was a case where the battle did not go to the strong, as in verse 11. Though this may be because a battle was averted. Something possibly like this actually occurred during the reign of David. In 2 Samuel 20:13-22, we're told that Sheba, who led a rebellion against David, fled to Abel of Beth Maacah, and David's general Joab besieged the city. A wise woman came forward and worked out with Joab that if the people of Abel gave up Sheba, they would be left in peace. And so they then threw out Sheba's head, and Joab withdrew. We don't know that the woman's name was forgotten at the time, but as it is not given in the account, that could be. The siege of Abel was not the exact occasion described in Ecclesiastes 9:13-16, though it could have provided a model for it. In any case, we see the poor wise man who saved the city in the present story forgotten. Expositor's comments. It was all part of the vanity and frustration of a self-centered world. Moreover, it was undoubtedly humiliating for the people to admit that they had been saved by a nobody. Note on verses 13 to 15. The New American Commentary points out that wisdom is sought out only in desperate times. Otherwise, only those who have wealth or power are in a position to demand public attention. Garrett. Note on verses 13 to 16. Expositors continues, what are we to conclude from this illustration? Certainly not that in view of the changes and chances of life we are better off not to use our gifts. It was right for the poor man to come forward and use his wisdom to thwart, or turn away, the king. It would have been right for him to do so even if he had known that his fellow citizens would not ask his advice in the future. Note on verse 16. Kaiser agrees, although the poor, wise man failed to profit personally from his labors, his wisdom was not profitless for others or for this world. Ecclesiastes, Total Life, p. 105. Indeed, his wisdom was of great value. Solomon says this example shows that wisdom is better than strength. Verse 16, a thought. Perhaps a proverb, that is paralleled a couple verses later where he says that wisdom is better than weapons of war, verse 18. Recall also Solomon earlier presenting wisdom as a defense, and as giving more strength than 10 military leaders in a city, Ecclesiastes 7:12, Ecclesiastes 7:19. This magnifies the directive we're given in Ecclesiastes 9:10 to do whatever we do with our might. Clearly what we do should also be with wisdom, which is better than might, and we are to share wisdom with others, even if there is no reward or respect to follow, as with the poor man here, where verse 16 has nevertheless, the word could just be and, Young's literal translation, while some versions have though or even though, ESV. Thus the statement would mean that wisdom is better even when it's despised and not listened to. Ultimately, the citizens were the real losers, failing to benefit further from the poor man's wisdom. Expositors, note on verses 17 to 18. Still, we see here another limitation of wisdom despite its value, that it may go unheard or unheeded. The words of the wise are often given as quiet, thoughtful assessment, but we see them ignored and shouted over in verse 17, even by a ruler, who is thereby obstinate and foolish. The sinner of verse 18 could be such a leader disregarding the wisdom of the wise as beneath him and his courtiers, even squashing it, so that it cannot be wielded as needed for the good it would do. Wisdom offered can deliver a city and continue to give further help, but if ignored or drowned out by foolishness, the result will be ruin. However, it's possible that the sinner in verse 18, if going with what follows in the next verse, Ecclesiastes 10:1, is a reference to a wise man hurting his own credibility by sin, as Solomon himself had done. But, as such was not the example just given, this would if meant seem to constitute a new thought. The connection with what came before would be the superiority of wisdom over physical might, yet with wisdom still having weakness, previously that it went unheeded by others and here that it sometimes goes unheeded by even those who give it. Of course, it is also generally true that one sinner can destroy much good. One of the common tragedies of life is how one evil person can do so much harm, and even more in this modern age when a single terrorist or a few working together can kill and injure many people and wreak terrible destruction. One person in a church can do something so scandalous that it makes the whole church look bad to the public. One bad parent can create a cycle of sin and suffering that affects generations. And one person can bring terrible consequences on others. Recall what happened in the Israelite conquest of the Promised Land. Did not Achan the son of Zerah commit a trespass in the accursed thing, and wrath fell on all the congregation of Israel? And that man did not perish alone in his iniquity, Joshua 22:20. Sin is disastrous for the sinner and often for others, sometimes many others. We should note that there is no narrative break between the end of Ecclesiastes 9 and the beginning of chapter 10. But the apparently proverbial statements at the end of chapter 9, in verses 16 to 18 beginning with "Then I said," are evidently in response to the example of the poor man in the besieged city in verses 13 to 15, while the proverbs of chapter 10 are being used for more general observations, with Ecclesiastes 10:1 as transitional, as we'll note more about in a moment. In fact, except for a single personal observation in chapter 10, verses 5 to 7, Ecclesiastes 9:16 through to the conclusion of the book starting in Ecclesiastes 12:8 is essentially a series of proverbs and proverbial poems set in order. Compare Ecclesiastes 12:9 to outline, in progressive form, how we must proceed through this life. Moving on to chapter 10, then, Solomon here offers us a number of proverbs and a wise observation, after laying the groundwork for receiving them in what he's been saying. As Expositor's notes, the teacher has returned to the subject of wisdom being superior to folly, even when it fails to gain the recognition it deserves, Ecclesiastes 9:13-18. So this is an appropriate place for another series of wise sayings, cf. Ecclesiastes 7:1-12, relating to guidance for life. Note on verse 1. Recall that the first proverb in the earlier series of proverbs in chapter 7 said, "A good name is better than precious ointment." Verse 1. Now we read about a fly in the ointment, or, rather, dead flies, plural, or even flies of death, notes commentator John Gill, as causing a bad smell and hurting the person otherwise reputed to have wisdom and honor. Clearly these two proverbs, Ecclesiastes 7:1 and Ecclesiastes 10:1, are related. In the previous case, an established good reputation was as a good smell, so that interacting with others was a positive experience for them. Now the reputation is as perfume tainted by dead flies. It has become disgusting, in appearance and effect. It was highly valued, costly, and now it has become worthless, as refuse. And note that it takes only a little folly to bring this about, just as flies are small but loathsome. In modern parlance, a fly in the ointment, taken from this verse, refers to a small defect or irritant that spoils the value, enjoyment or success of something. In the proverb, it destroys a wise person's credibility, As the end of the previous verse about a sinner destroying much good, Ecclesiastes 9:18, might also relate to. Kaiser contends that Solomon does not refer to that trace of folly in a wise man or the lapses of the otherwise good man. He instead refers to the tendency for folly to predominate over honorable wisdom, as was seen in Ecclesiastes 16-17 with wisdom shouted down and ignored, p. 106. That is, he takes this to be an issue of a government's or ruler's reputation where foolishness is allowed to regularly prevail over wisdom. Yet the wording of Ecclesiastes 10:1 concerns one known for wisdom allowing foolishness to prevail only a little. That does not seem to fit with the large-scale suppression of wisdom by the ruler of fools in Ecclesiastes 9:17, though it could indeed refer to an otherwise wise king or government giving in to folly just enough to make the rule seem abhorrent to people. In any case, wisdom's value being diminished through sin in Ecclesiastes 9:18 provides a transition to the consequences of a little folly in Ecclesiastes 10:1. We should note the putrefying effect of the flies here. Not only is it revolting to the senses, but rot and contamination are indeed spread throughout the ointment. We may compare this with the effects of sin, with spiritual rot and corruption being spread throughout whatever is infected. As Paul said in comparing sin to leavening, pointing out why we are to remove leaven from our lives as a symbolic measure during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? 1 Corinthians 5:6. So it is with the sin and foolishness represented by the flies of death. Consider that one of the names of Satan is Beelzebub, Matthew 12:24. Meaning Lord or Master of Flies. Indeed, he is the master of sin and foolishness, attracting people to spiritual filth, decay and death and leading them to spread all this on to others. Allowing foolishness and sin to prevail in any situation will bring spreading corruption and ruined lives and reputations. Rulers must avoid this, as individuals clearly must as well. We must all strive for righteousness and wisdom, giving no place to wickedness and folly. When we fail in this, we must strive to set things right. Sometimes, though, our reputation may be damaged beyond recovery. Still, we should work to earn back trust as much as is possible. Yet before even landing in this situation, we must always remember that it's best to not bring harm to our reputation in the first place, and recognize that we are better able to serve God in being an example of wisdom and righteousness to others if we ourselves remain above reproach. Again, we see in all this a limitation of wisdom despite its value. It can be negated by a little foolishness or sin. We are thus encouraged to develop and live by wisdom, but with the realization that our efforts in this will take us only so far. Maintaining a right relationship with God is paramount, which is itself the height of wisdom. End.